This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman. This is London FinTech Podcast, episode 79. Brought to you in association with Archhaver, Smart Pension and Synchron. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Darren Meek, London FS Lead at PricewaterhouseCoopers, to discuss challenger banks in the UK. An apparently straightforward topic, but one I recall reading a comment about another podcast who covered it, quotes, "These guys don't appear to understand challenger banks," unquotes. Well, I doubt anyone can completely understand anything. However, when it comes to challenger banks, my eye was caught by PwC's recent report, "Who You Calling a Challenger?" Or rather, it wasn't caught by the title, but the thoroughness of the work. I quote, "A vibrant group of banking businesses is emerging in the UK, often described as challenger banks. These banks are not any of the recognised main high street banks, RBS, HSBC, Lloyds, Barclays, Santander, but they've received significant attention in recent years primarily for their means of driving innovation and improving customer service levels in the market. While this development is potentially exciting, the diversity of these banks is not widely understood. Too often it is assumed that the challenger banks are all cut from the same cloth and that they face identical market dynamics. To challenge such misleading assumptions and to better understand how the opportunities available to these banks can be exploited, PwC has interviewed dozens of CEOs and senior executives from these organisations while working with YouGov to establish consumers' views and preferences as the banking industry evolves. So even if not everything is known, what is known is very well grounded in a methodology and some real time at the coal faces of both the producers and the consumers. Just to break the habit of a lifetime and have a pretty professionally written intro for a change, I'll wrap up with the executive summary of where the report is at. Our report documents the findings of our research in detail, the depth and breadth of the challenger bank segment, the regulatory impediments to new entrants' progress, the promise of technology and the priorities for each category of new player. It is aimed at all stakeholders with an interest or possible role in transforming the UK's banking industry for the better. Sounds good. And as Darren has 26 years in this sector, he's well enough grounded in where we have been, as well as where we are, to give us some hardcore insights into where we're going. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Darren, thanks for joining me today.
Hi Mike, thanks very much for having me.
So we were talking about holidays, and I'm particularly got holidays in mind, as I'm going on holiday in a couple of days' time, although by the time this is out, I will sadly have been on holiday, or hopefully gladly have been on holiday, but be back to the office. And it turns out that we're both sort of gravitate towards Southeast Asia off and on.
Yeah, I love travelling, and as my family will know, I have a tremendous interest in history and culture. And one of the things that I'm fascinated by is the way in which the Hindu influence has spread outside India into large parts of the rest of Southeast Asia. And some of the great temples that we talk about today, for example, Angkor Wat, Prambanan in Java, not as many people know that they were built as part of that Hindu spread of influence.
Yes, all empires expand and recede, including the Hindu one and the British one, and no doubt at some point the American one and the Soviet Union has as well. And as you say, if you go around these places, everyone tends to say Southeast Asia these days. But I think when I was younger, people would use the phrase Indochina much more, and certainly around the time of the Vietnam War and all that kind of stuff. And it's obviously, as you are an expert in, it's not just a geographic term, it's a cultural term. There's a lot of amalgamation between sort of Indo ideas and Chinese ideas. And I was in Siem Reap, where Angkor Wat is, in last November, actually, and going back to my ignorance, I thought Angkor Wat was a temple. Well, it kind of is a temple. It's a very huge one. But there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of temples there.
There are thousands there. And some of the others that are lesser known but important and fascinate me are the Cham Misun temples in Vietnam, the Batu Caves in Malaysia, and the Bigan temple region in Burma, which my son has recently been lucky enough to visit. So, yeah, I'm fascinated by that. And it means I spend a lot of time thinking about where I'm going to go next.
Yes, I think for most people, the main interaction with the spread of Hinduism, you can tell me how far it got, but must be one of the furthest outposts, is Bali, which still has a Hindu culture.
That's right.
To this day. I mean, did it get much further than Bali? Because I mean, you're basically in Papua New Guinea and other strange places by then.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been learning more and more about it, so perhaps when we meet next, I'll be able to answer that one.
Yes. my holiday coming up is very uncultural. I'm just going to sort of, for a change, do something which is very unlike me and try and laze on a beach. I'm not actually very good at doing nothing, but I shall try my best to do nothing. And then, as we were just saying, by the time I come back in June, it's the season for sort of going around and looking at next year's sponsorship of the podcast and doing quarterly briefings to clients and all that kind of stuff. So it's straight back in at the deep end. And I found the weather has got very hard to predict all around the world. I mean, we've been to Southeast Asia, and I don't know, recently in kind of September and October and November, and quite often found it cold. So, for example, in Chiang Mai, northern Thailand, it was 18 degrees one day in October, which is just crazy for there. And the monsoon seemed far less stable. Anyway, sort of getting away from holiday fantasies, it's going to be very hard to come back to fintech. So quite often I talk to folks about their career journey from when they started to now. But as far as I can see, in terms of labels, your career journey was relatively straightforward, and you did what not so many people do these days, which is you join one company and you're still there, which is certainly less hassle from one perspective than going through many, many companies. So how did that work when you sort of joined PwC, or was it Pricewaterhouse and Coopers & Lybrand in those days?
In fact, it was Coopers & Lybrand Deloitte when I joined. Uh-huh. I joined straight from university. My father was an accountant, and I wasn't sure what to do and thought it would be a great opportunity to learn something about business and then make a decision. As it happens, I've loved being here, and over the years, I've gravitated towards financial services. And one of the great things about being here is that we have enough scale of practice. It means I can spend all my time working within financial services. It wasn't always that way. I started off working with restaurant chains, engineering companies. But today I focus exclusively on financial services.
Yes, and over the time it's only got more and more complex with larger organisations, both on the professional services providers such as the Big Four, but obviously on the client side as well. So having seen it for the better part of 30 years, the waves of change wax and wane, what times did you just find as an individual sort of interesting times to be working in the sphere?
I've had some really interesting moments. I spent some time working with our business recovery practice in my earlier years, and although the stories weren't always great because often it was dealing with companies that had run into difficulty, our ability to help turn those around in many fields was a very interesting experience for me, and very rewarding when things were able to turn around. I've spent some time in New York, which was fascinating. So I was in New York at the time of 9/11, living and working out there. And then in recent years, I've been able to focus in very specific terms on the UK retail banking market. And that's what brought me to the Challenger Bank sector, which I'm particularly interested in. And it's been great that I've been able to sort of focus on things that I enjoy learning about and I think are important for us all.
Yes, there are some huge benefits of having the old-fashioned career where you join a company that's got a vast range of possibilities within it, which was called in the old days when I did a lot of work in Japan, the spiral staircase in a Japanese company. You move around and then you go up, and if you're doing okay and you've got quite a bit of choice of what you're doing and what you can focus on. So that leads quite nicely into the Challenger Banks, where, as I say, I was impressed by your research in a world where actually pretty much everything that's said about fintech is, I feel on a bad day, sort of trite, superficial and wrong. It's quite nice to actually come across some research where people have really dug into it and taken a kind of, well, from a journalistic perspective or research perspective, what Julian Assange calls primary journalism, you know, speaking to the chief executive of a challenger bank. You could, for example, ask me my views on the outlook for insurtech, and I can give you a view, but it's not a primary view. It'd be based on the views of other people, who in many cases have got views about other people's views. So you've got down to the coalface. So just to start things off, because I was reflecting just before I was here, that in a world where there's rapid change, we kind of come up with new phrases to label that change. The change continues while the new phrase is there. The new phrase is never particularly well defined, and different people see them differently, and over time the phenomenon mutates and the phrase mutates. No better example than fintech, for example. You know, you can say fintech, does it include challenger banks or doesn't it include challenger banks? You know, is Metro a challenger bank? Is Metro not a challenger bank, etc., etc.? So in terms of your report, where did you come from in terms of what you mean by the phrase challenger banks?
So we're very interested in competition in UK banking, and we're very interested in the impact that this range of new, innovative, growing banks is having on the UK banking community. And we wanted to look at really what was going on there. We also felt that many people were just referring to that group in simple terms, and it wasn't really doing justice to all of the great things that were going on in the background. So we wanted to look at that afresh. We wanted to really get behind the what was going on. We wanted to talk to the people making things happen, and we wanted to look at where the future of that nascent sector of the industry was going to be. One of the really interesting things that we found out was that when you look past the label challenger, there are, we think, four principal groups of banks that are recognisable. And just to give you a few examples of those, there are some digital-only banks that have entered the market, an example of that being Monzo. Some specialist banks that are ploughing very particular niche areas and doing so incredibly well. An example of that would be Aldermore, looking at supporting Britain's entrepreneurs. There are some non-bank brands, and by that I mean traditional brands, traditional corporates.
Tesco's and
Sainsbury's. Tesco's, GE, and most recently Ford. And you'll have seen Ford Money has recently launched in the UK. Some really tremendous, strong brands that are branching out and using those to, again, bring a different dynamic to the UK banking sector. And then there's a group of full-service banks. So, for example, the TSB that used to be part of Lloyds Banking Group. And then there are some others that are a bit different, that aren't as easily classified. And you mentioned Metro, and that's a great example. Metro was one of the first new high street banks in many, many years, perhaps the first one in 100 years. It's approached the market with a retailing point of view. It is focused on service, convenience, and interestingly, it's one of the few banks that is actively opening branches, whereas many of the other established banks are closing. And they believe that the best banking service involves all sorts of different ways of accessing your bank. A couple of other mentions of interesting developments. Handelsbanken, not talked about hugely, but quietly opening branches, growing.
And they're an excellent bank, aren't they? Their reputation is fantastic.
And operating, you know, quite successfully behind the scenes. And one that caught my eye recently, Triodos, which is a less well-known, it's an ethical bank headquartered in the Netherlands. It's recently announced plans to launch a new current account in the UK. And one of the features that's caught people's attention is that it's been very transparent about its plans to make small charges to cover the cost of providing that service. And I think that's another interesting change that we haven't really seen before. That's been something that, in terms of charging for current accounts, it's not a feature that the UK market has supported.
So that's a good deconstruction of it. And in a way, if we wanted to avoid the language challenger bank, then we could simply say there are many retail banks in the UK, whatever it is now these days, five or six are really big and well-known. All the other banks are what falls under the rubric of challenger banks. And I think there's, you know, in the sort of miscellaneous category or even in a new category, you've got the likes of Zopa, which are busy becoming a bank or opening a bank. Let's not get bogged down in their language around it as well. So, as you point out, it's a very diverse phenomena with people who have got some pretty different aims and motivations. So I guess the question is, why are we seeing this profusion of different types of banks or the speciation of banks? What do you think the factors are driving this phenomenon?
So I think the UK market got to a point where, by anybody's standards, there was a limited number of retail banking providers, the established banks, and there'd been a great deal of consolidation in the market, one of the things we touch on in our report. And that sense of sort of looking to spur new competition created some opportunity for investors, management teams to look at the market and go, could we do better? Could we do something different? Could we bring some fresh ideas to the market? I think most people may know that just purely financially, some of the returns that can be achieved in the UK banking market are quite impressive. So there's money to be made as well as better service, better experience to be provided. And I think a combination of those factors created the appetite. And then the other very important thing was that the UK regulators also signalled that greater competition was something that they would encourage. And perhaps back in Certainly sort of 2010 onwards, 2013 was notable for a change in approach from the primary regulator, the PRA, to try and make the opportunity for coming into the market a simpler, more efficient route. And as a result of all of those factors, we've seen some really fantastic new ideas coming into the market. We've seen 20 or so new banks licensed since 2010.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It really is. And a lot of them are bringing some fantastic ideas to the market. And that's creating meaningful change across the sector as a whole. And I'll come back to in a moment some of the things that some of the more established banks are doing as well, which, you know, recognises that everybody's playing a part here in creating better consumer experiences, options and outcomes.
Yes, you mentioned in terms of the first category, the digital only, Monzo, who've just passed 5,000 downloads, the most downloaded show from the London FinTech podcast. And when Tom was on the show, I was asking him why he felt that retail banking in the UK was such an opportunity, because some time ago it was made easy for people to switch current accounts, or far easier than it was, and not many people really bothered. And most of the surveys I saw was that if you ask people to write down their 100 problems or even 100 commercial problems, that the current account wasn't really in them. You know, for consumers in the UK, the current account is free, and if you don't go into an overdraft, which most people don't, and it does kind of work and all that kind of stuff, and I've had banking services for, I don't know, 30-odd years, and I haven't found much to grumble at. So I just kind of, I mean, I can intellectually, if it was an exam, I could write down some waffle or some bullshit about, you know, why all these things are happening. But at a gut level, I somehow don't particularly get it, because retail banking does pretty much everything I want to do. Now, one of the answers to this has been, well, you know, you're such an old fuddy-duddy, Mike, you can't imagine all these exciting new things you could do, and we're going to give you exciting new things you can do, and all that kind of thing. So just to take Monzo as an example, I do use their card. And actually, I have found it very useful to have geolocated expenses, because otherwise, I got to the end of the month, I got my sort of MasterCard bill, and I'd be looking at something, some funny transaction code, and thinking, what was this? Where was that? And I could be like scratching my head for days, and then suddenly, oh, I know what it was. So there are things like that, but I'm not sure that we've got 20 new banks just to give us geolocation, for example.
What you've highlighted, though, is that the new banks are bringing fantastic ideas, and Monzo is very purposefully aiming to provide the best current account in the market. And there's no easy way of defining that, or there isn't a definition of what that means. But the example you gave of geolocated expenses, it's one thing that makes people's lives easier, helps people keep control of their finances, helps people understand what's going on with their finances. For me, that's just a great example of being more relevant and consumer-friendly. There are other digital-only banks. Atom is a mobile-only bank. I read recently that its head of retail mortgages had mentioned that they had completed their first mortgage application to completion within 9 working days.
That's certainly better than it was.
Which is a fabulous achievement. I mean, if you deconstruct the mortgage process, there are lots of moving parts that are quite hard to influence. They've managed to get speed into the process. I'll give you another example. Barclays have got a service called TrackIt, which allows you to understand where you are at any point in time in the mortgage application process. That's a relatively new service. It's something that they've introduced, which means that you have better transparency over where you stand. And that's really sometimes what people want. So lots of really great ideas coming to the fore. The other thing that I've noticed is that there's an increasing trend of using face and voice recognition. Again, in the spirit of helping consumers, customers, people to access and use their banking services.
Is that remembering stupidly long passwords?
Absolutely. I read somewhere recently that Lloyds have been exploring how to use Amazon's Alexa as one way of, you know, could you possibly talk to something like that and affect a banking transaction? Is something that is unheard of.
Yes, yes. Well, I buy all that, and it's a very good answer. And I think you conclusively prove that I'm not the person to disrupt retail banking in the UK, because I've been going on this misapprehension that it's OK. And I guess another reason why there's all this activity is that, as you say, that retail banking in the UK can be profitable. Ergo, that means you can actually provide things at a lower cost to the public. And so taking Monzo and Revolut, they give very good FX exchange rates. And Revolut, of course, is managing to provide some kind of banking, or should we say financial services, in a non-bank wrapper as well. So I like this point about the diversity. I like this speciation within it, that if we deleted the phrase challenger banks, we'd have these digital-only banks would have these specialist banks and non-bank branded and all these other types. So the question then arises, which is that, well, that's nice, isn't it? Because people have got lots of choice. But in the oligopolistic world we're in, and in a world where we don't want 1,000 apps on our phone, we struggle to use more than half a dozen, how successful can all these banks be? I mean, are we going to see 20 fantastic new banks in 10 years' time in terms of the ones that formed since 2010, or will there be about 1.5 left in 10 years' time?
So when I've spoken to chief executives, management teams, very few of them have entered the market with the ambition of becoming one of the large next established banks. They have a very specific aim, an area that they want to develop, and you know, they're focused on that. But can I just give you an interesting fact? You mentioned, like, why would people switch accounts? Two things that we've learned through our research. One is that people don't really necessarily equate current accounts and banking in the way that they used to. People are much more comfortable these days having one current account and using other banks for other services, or even having multiple current accounts. And that's a feature that we are seeing more and more of. The other thing that's interesting, just thinking about the question around why aren't more people switching accounts, the research that we've done has indicated that 57% of people that have switched in the last 3 years have done so because there's been a more attractive option, a financial incentive, a positive reason for switching. It hasn't been because of dissatisfaction with their current provider.
That's interesting, actually, because especially when it comes to the banking, the commercial banking side, as I've whinged before on the podcast, while I've been relatively happy with the retail banking services I've got over the decades, I haven't been on that. So on the business side, if I actually bothered to get off my derriere, I would change because of dissatisfaction. But it's interesting on the retail side, as you say, that actually people are going for different things. As I say, I just charred the Monzo card because Tom gave me one day. Mm-hmm. And I actually quite liked it, and it's quite convenient. So it's interesting this asymmetry between jumping out of the frying pan and jumping into nirvana, as it were. Although nirvana is a Buddhist concept, not a Hindu concept.
One of the interesting things about the, I call it commercial sector, so the SME banking sector, small businesses, large businesses, it highlights that we must think about all of these different segments of the market quite differently. We tend to generalise, yes, retail and commercial, yes, banking, and they are quite different in terms of the driving forces, the requirements. The government has wanted greater competition in that sector, and it's being achieved in different ways. But I'll give you an example of something that's out there that I guess brings together some of these strands. One is the government has supported the banking business website, and I'm not sure if you've heard of it. We talk about it in our report. It's a bit like bringing TripAdvisor to commercial banking services.
Okay.
It allows and has allowed thousands of businesses to rate their banks based on price, service. A very interesting idea.
This is fascinating because when I had your colleague Jonathan Howe on last year talking about an equally in-depth report into insurance tech, where I think they interviewed 2,400 people. So the insurance people are making you guys look relatively lazy with only having interviewed dozens and dozens of chief executives. They did thousands. But one of the challenges, as we know, in insurance is that it still pretty much sells on price, but not quality. You know, you can't go to an equivalent of a TripAdvisor or an Amazon and find out that insurance company X is just dire at paying and takes forever, and insurance company Y doesn't, actually. So I hadn't dived in that far to find that there was such a thing being set up and the government was actually driving it.
Yeah, so it's supported by HM Treasury. The other thing that you've probably seen is that some of the banks are, in terms of transparency, publishing a lot of the feedback they get from their customers now on their websites as a means of supporting, you know, sort of helping people choose them based on quality of service and other factors than just price. So I think now if you go to many of the bank's websites, you'll see some of that information provided. And I think that's been a big step forward as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, this whole transparency thing does increase. I saw something this week which had done a report onto high street retailers and, you know, the balance of sort of favourable and unfavourable opinions, and they've got a top 100 or they've taken 100, and, you know, they've got a sort of league table of the best ones and the worst ones. And actually, I better not mention any names as PricewaterhouseCoopers because you're probably doing about a quarter of them. But I was quite interested in the results, actually. And to the extent that we get to the same kind of thing, I don't like the phrase democratising, but it's slightly democratising, or it's slightly consumer focused. If you for the sake of argument, end up with some league table of business banks rated by how much their customers love them. You mentioned TripAdvisor. It's a bit like Checkatrade, really. Checkatrade, to me, has revolutionised how I use plumbers or electricians.
Yeah.
Because you can find some guy that's got 128 five-star reviews, or you can go to the bloke who's got 1.5 one-star reviews. And it really does change things. So this is an example of where the government is stimulating, in a sense, greater transparency and greater information for consumers and making the market more efficient. I mean, what other things has the government been up to in terms of prodding this?
We identified four or so primary structural challenges that we thought needed to be addressed in order to spur even further and greater strides in competition in the UK. One of those was how banks are required to hold capital against their business. So when you make a loan as a bank, you're required to keep a certain proportion of that as capital to protect stakeholders in the bank. That is sometimes talked about as there being an uneven playing field, and I'll try and summarise it. When you calculate the amount of capital you need to hold against the business you do, there are different ways of doing that. Some of the more established banks have been able to use something called an advanced approach, which means they can use their own track records and data to determine how much capital is required.
With their internal models.
Exactly. If you don't have that data and you don't have that track record, it's been quite difficult to get your own models approved by the regulators. And that's forced a number of the newer banks to hold more capital in some areas, in some, not all, but in some areas. And one of the things that the government has been doing, and most recently, the PRA, at a conference in March this year that we co-hosted with the BBA, Martin Stewart announced a revised approach to how the PRA would look at that capital landscape. And one of the key things there is that we expect to see a greater amount of discretion applied in terms of how some of the capital requirements and discretionary elements are determined. The other thing that we identified is that as a bank, as you would expect, you have to comply with regulatory requirements, reporting requirements. You need to provide information to your regulators, and that all makes complete sense. There was a feeling that, in relative terms, some of the newer banks were having to contribute more of their resources and time to that than was perhaps fair. That's one thing that I think the government is also looking at in terms of what is a proportionate way of overseeing the banks coming into the market. A third area was access to the UK central payment systems.
Yes, FPS.
Absolutely. And it's very important that banks are able to access those payment systems confidently, efficiently. And in the past, there have been four banks that have effectively controlled access to those.
The old-fashioned clearing banks, I assume.
That's right, the clearing banks. And if you wanted to access, you used to have to go through one of those banks. And for many, that was a perfectly acceptable way of doing things, and it worked. Some of the banks want to have direct access. You know, for example, Metro, Starling, they've both taken direct access themselves. It gives them more ability to control that access. They're not subject to, you know, sort of downtimes that other banks have just for doing repairs or housekeeping. So they have direct access. And the other thing that's happened, and I think is very interesting, is you'll have heard of this ClearBank, which has come on the scene recently. It's going to be, all things being well, the first new clearing bank in more than 250 years. And what they are looking to do is to effectively be a bank for banks. They're going to be providing access to the payments systems for other banks. They won't be competing. They're not going to be providing
current accounts,
retail banking services, or any other banking services.
Yes, it's interesting. And you give a very eloquent and clear description of what's going on. And listening to you talk, I'm aware that my knowledge is a bit like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Quite a lot of what you've been speaking about, I know, is little bits of a jigsaw puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never actually put it together to make such an interesting picture of the overall landscape and of really how radical what's going on at the moment. And again, partly because journalism doesn't make any money and they've got young journalists without much experience, and also partly because everything's too short these days and 150 characters or whatever it is on Twitter and short articles. If you ever see anything about challenger banks, it doesn't get much further than sort of debating what a challenger bank is in the first place, throwing in one or two names, and actually doesn't have the time. And it's been like, I put a lot of effort in the London FinTech podcast into trying to get into some depth on some of the issues. So, you know, each couple of weeks you can hear about something in some depth. And I think that's why your report attracted my attention, because if you drill down far enough, you really get a clear understanding of what's going on. And it's actually a very fascinating tales. So that's kind of where we are at the moment, and I do encourage people to actually go and check out your report, which is freely available online. I think you have to register for it, but you don't have to pay anything, and it certainly costs a lot of money to do that. And the sort of impossible question is always, what's tomorrow look like, or even next week, or the week after that? Where do you think this is all going to be going? What trends do you think are going to continue for a few years, and how's it going to shake out?
So I think that we are seeing increased expectations from consumers and businesses with respect to the quality of service they receive. We are seeing that speed and convenience are becoming more and more important to people. Transparency in financial products and people's ability to access financial products that suit them is becoming more and more important. Questions of trust are also driving the direction of travel here. Interestingly, our research told us that 18% of people that we surveyed are already working with or would look to open an account, just keeping it focused on that one product, with a digital-only bank in the next 3 years. That's a relatively low number, and I think it highlights the need for greater brand awareness, greater name awareness, and greater differentiation on behalf of those looking to make their mark in the market. We're seeing that people are more and more happy to access different banks for different services, which means that banks need to think about their provision differently. And we're also seeing greater demands for what I call bespoke service. So segments of the market that want bespoke service are prepared to pay for bespoke service, effectively not the commoditization.
Yes, it's interesting. And so you're really painting a picture there where, if you want to use the phrase of pendulum, the pendulum is swinging away from sort of a producer-driven system and towards something that's more in the consumer interest.
Yeah, the customer experience is becoming critical. And what I've seen is that not only are we seeing great ideas, great change coming into the market from the new entrants, we're also seeing some tremendous advances from the established banks. I think everybody would agree that, all told, that is good for the UK consumer, and the UK customer experience will only benefit from all of the innovation and focus that's being brought to bear.
Absolutely. You mentioned Barclays earlier with a product that allows you to see where you are on your mortgage thing. I mean, mortgages is a prime example. I mean, '70s, it took you whatever 3 or 6 months to get a mortgage. And these days, no one would wait for that. And it's quite an optimistic message overall for me in terms of the consumer swing, because I've been concerned macroeconomically across all the economic sectors that the oligopolization that I've seen in the last 20, 30 years, which means that you've got a few players dominating every industry, whether it's telecoms or whether it's pharma and all that kind of stuff, you end up in a very producer-driven system, and the consumer sort of gets a pretty similar, to take telecoms, gets a pretty similar service from all the main providers. I mean, like many people, I've been through quite a lot of the providers by now, and it's all, you know, relatively similar. Whereas this speciation that you're talking about here is absolutely in the opposite direction, and all this digital stuff, I mean, just dropping the word fintech, the impact of digital on FS is clearly changing the dynamics considerably below the surface, even if the sort of, you know, all you actually see in the newspapers is more bank branches are closed, and you walk down, you still see the same names that you would have seen some time ago. So it's all very exciting. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I appreciate every one of you. And my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, Smart, Simple and Transparent P2P Business Lending, loans to £3 million for SMEs delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Synchron, digital, business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS, from startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and $400 million of revenue. So, coming on to PwC and what you're doing in Challenger Banks, Darren, you've very kindly given us some of the key highlights and set out, to be honest, what I found to be a far more interesting picture than I realised in terms of what's going on. So, what interesting is going on in your part of PwC?
Well, we're working with lots of people, as you can imagine, management teams, investors and regulators, to bring greater competition to the UK banking sector. If I would refer you to anything, our report, as you've mentioned, Who Are You Calling a Challenger?, brings to life some of the research we've done and some of the really important trends that we are seeing. I would recommend listeners look at our de novo service, PwC's de novo. It's a digital front door to our financial services practice, allowing you to access our insight and expertise in a different and new way. And then in terms of some of the other things that we're doing, if there are areas that we focus on, they are innovation, digitalization, you talked about, is an enabler. We're helping organizations make most of that, looking at how to increase and improve their customer experience. We're also helping people building banks from scratch. We launched our Bank in a Box service last year at one of the FinTech Weeks. We are working with and helping a large number of investors and management teams become authorized. We've got the largest market share in that. We're also able to help teams with fundraising. We have a strong track record in fundraising support. So those are the sorts of areas that I would highlight.
Excellent. Well, I'm so enthused about it all, I shall go away and consider turning the London FinTech Podcast into a bank, because clearly it's the thing to do. Or maybe if I turn myself into a bank, that will be ringing the bell for the top of the markets. But there's clearly enough to keep you guys busy, and there's a lot of interesting things happening in this area, and time's gone by, and we've really just only touched on some of the sort of main headings and subheadings, and there's plenty of more detail, as I say. So I wish you every success in that area. And I was also thinking, going back to old days of FS, a chap called Brian Knox, who was a Goose and Grant stockbroker partner. And back in the old days of stockbroking, this is pre-Big Bang in 85, pre-1985, it was more gentlemanly hours for everyone. And in his spare time, he managed to knock off two books about architecture in Poland and one about architecture in Czechland, when it was the old Iron Curtain, when it was really hard to get there. So do let me know, and I'll just let the listeners know, if at some point you have the chance to knock off a book about Hindu architecture and influence throughout Southeast Asia, because I think it's a fascinating topic, and I'll be interested in that as well as the Challenger Bank report. So thank you for that, Darren.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or FinTech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.